I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Our guest, Lawrence Lessig, used crowdsourcing to raise money for candidates last year who supported campaign finance reform. His Mayday PAC raised $11 million from 60,000 contributors, spent $10.5 million on 8 candidates, 2 of whom won. Lessig is passionate about how money perverts elections when a tiny percent of the population donates most of the money and candidates spend an inordinate amount of time asking for money. He writes about this in his book, The USA is Lesterland, where he also lays out a plan to empower small donors. This is a good time to talk about his ideas with the announcement that the Koch brothers are planning on spending $889 million, almost $1 billion, on their favorite candidates in next year's election. Lawrence Lessig joins us by telephone. He's a professor of law at Harvard University and the director of the university's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what's your takeaway from your Mayday PAC and the effect it had on the election last year?
Well, I think the biggest lesson we learned is just how hard it is to get people to separate their partisan obsession from something they also believe, which is the deep corruption of the system, and to get them to act to change the corruption of the system. We found 96% of Americans think it's important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but 91% don't think it's possible. So it's really challenging to give people a sense that it is possible and to give them the motivation they need to do something to bring that about. And you know, we could see in the polling after the election, the message was very salient in these districts, but we didn't succeed in demonstrating that we had a clear path to rallying people to vote for reform candidates, and we're back to the drawing board to figure out what's next.
Do you need more money? Would that help?
I'm not sure it's about money. I actually think it's about people understanding that this is something different from ordinary politics. You know, one of the problems we had is we, you know, stepped in and we tried to help ordinary candidates running in their races with the traditional tools of politics, you know, advertisements on television. And it was hard for people to see that that was anything different from the same old way the system works. And so hard to get people really excited about the possibility that this could be something different. And I think what that means is we need to think more aggressively about how to do it differently, like how to approach people in a way that doesn't feel just partisan, doesn't feel like you're, you know, really a tool for the Democratic Party or something like that, and really unites people regardless of their political view. Because our belief, really fundamental belief, is regardless of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, conservative or a liberal, this corrupt system of funding campaigns makes it impossible for you to get anything you want from our government. We've just, you know, come to the place that the government doesn't function anymore, and we have to step back and say, okay, what do we need to do to fix it so that we can actually have a government that responds to whomever, you know, wins the election.
Is part of the problem is that this is legal corruption, to use your word, legal corruption?
Yeah, that is the most important part. You know, people love to talk about this as if it's about a bunch of criminals or a bunch of really evil people in Congress. But it's not. You know, members of Congress go to Congress for the best possible reasons. But they live within a system that forces them to behave in ways that separates them from the people, separates them because they don't spend time worrying about what the people care about. They spend time worrying about what the funders of their campaigns worry about. It's all perfectly legal. It's all perfectly constitutional. But it's all perfectly corrupt because the framers of our Constitution wanted a government where the Congress would be, quote, dependent on the people alone. And by the people, Madison said, he meant, quote, not the rich more than the poor. Well, we've evolved a system where the members of Congress are obsessively focused on what the rich care about, because it's only the rich, only the very, very rich, who are funding the campaigns. And so they spend 30 to 70% of their time talking to these tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%, so that they can fund their campaigns and then pretend to turn around and represent the rest of us when they actually vote.
You gave a TED Talk, and I think you said this was maybe a year or two ago, but something like 132 people spent or were donors and came up with something like 60% of the money for, I think it was a presidential campaign.
For the super PACs.
For the super PACs, exactly.
It's only gotten worse. In the last election cycle, about 1.75%, less than 2% of Americans gave anything to anybody. But of that less than 2%, 0.2% gave 66% of the total amount that was spent. The top 100 gave as much as the bottom 4.75 million. And that top 100 gave 70% of the super PAC money that was spent in that election cycle. So we've created the system where this tiny, tiny fraction of America is funding our campaigns. And it's no surprise that we therefore have a government that's incredibly eager to respond to the needs of that tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% by producing policies that benefit them without much concern about how it affects the rest of us.
As you said, most people are unhappy or even disturbed about the influence of money in politics. But, Lawrence Lessig, we don't see people taking to the streets on this. And I don't know if that's the only way that people can represent their frustration with the system. But it is interesting that this is not something that people feel is almost like a civil right.
That's right. And the question is why. Now, the politicos in Washington say the reason is because people don't really care about the issue. But actually, I don't think it's that people don't care. I think it's people don't think there's anything they can do. Again, that poll that we found, 96% thought it was important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but only 91% thought it was possible. That's the politics of resignation. At least 96% of us wish we could fly like Superman, but because at least 91% of us don't believe we can, we don't leap off of tall buildings regularly, right? And that's the same thing here. If you can give people a sense that there is, in fact, something that can be done, if you can give them a path, a credible path that they believe would actually change the system, I think you'd see an enormous amount of energy responding to this, because you've opened up the possibility of something people actually desperately, strongly want to do something about.
But do you think the fact that people maybe feel the system is rigged and perhaps rigged against them just makes them throw up their hands and say, I'm just a little guy. I have maybe $100 I want to give to someone. How am I going to go up against the Koch brothers, for instance, or some of these other big donors?
Yeah, I think that's exactly their reaction. And that explains why a huge percentage of Americans just don't even participate anymore in the political system. And I understand why. It's completely rational. Why should they? There's an amazing study done by Princeton professor Martin Gillens and Ben Page, published last fall, where it's the largest empirical study of policy decisions, actual policy decisions by our government in the history of political science. And what they did is they related those policy decisions to the attitudes of the elite, the economic elite, organized interests, and then the average voter. And they tried to see whose desires actually explained what our government actually did. And what they found was, as the economic elite supported a policy more, it was more likely that policy would be passed. And as organized interests supported a policy more, it was more likely that policy would be passed. But when the average voter supported a policy, it did not affect the probability of that policy being passed at all. It didn't change the probability of it passing at all. Even as we went from 0% of average voters supporting it to 100%, that didn't change the probability of it being adopted. Meaning, in this graph, it's a flat line relating America's democracy to what American voters care about. Now, in a democracy, the idea that the average voter's attitudes can't be shown to affect the actual decisions of the government at all, that's a pretty good signal that the democracy is no longer a democracy. And it's a pretty good reason for most Americans to say, look, I've got two jobs, or I've got kids, or I've got a hobby. I'm going to spend my time focused on that, because there's no reason to spend time focused on what politics is, because politics is just basically responding to what the economic elites or organized business interests want.
Do you see speech and money, that money is speech, as the Supreme Court has said, and that if we could figure out how to separate those two, that would open up more money? Or do we have to live with this idea that money is speech and then figure out how to do a workaround?
Look, I am a little bit different from most of the progressive reformers in this field, because I think money is speech. Of course money is speech. It's not literally speech. But I think if the government wants to restrict your ability to participate in a political debate, they need a pretty good reason for doing it. And that's all that means. That just means they've got a constitutional standard they've got to demonstrate to prove the right of the government to regulate. But the critical point is, we don't have to address or change or alter the Constitution at all, in my view, to address 90% of the problem that confronts our democracy right now. Because the problem is not, you know, the amount of corporate money in the political system. I mean, there is a significant amount, but it's a tiny fraction. It's probably less than 10%. It's not even the invisible money in the system. You know, the total amount of super PAC money in the last election was probably 15% of the total amount spent. And of that super PAC money, only about 40% was dark. Now, I think it all should be transparent, but the idea that this is the core problem is just missing the forest for the trees. The real core problem is the way we fund elections. The idea that we outsource to the tiniest fraction of the 1% the funding of elections. And that problem could be changed tomorrow through legislation that wouldn't require a constitutional amendment, wouldn't require a supermajority in Congress. It would just require a majority of Congress to vote to change the way we fund elections. And I think our focus should be on that core problem, because if we solve that, then we have begun the steps towards changing the fundamental corruption in the way our government works.
About a minute before our first break here. So are you bothered or not bothered that the Koch brothers are planning on spending almost $1 billion on next year's election? Does it matter to you?
I think it's a huge problem, because it is the continuation of what we've seen so far. It'll be, you know, just a couple hundred people literally spending as much as the Republican Party spent in the whole of this last congressional election. It is an incredible amount of money. And I think that's the trend we have to find a way to reverse. But the way to reverse it is to change the way we fund elections. And then once that change is done, then take on any constitutional problems that remain that, you know, are produced by this kind of super PAC spending inside of our political system.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and our guest is Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law at Harvard University, also the director of the university's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, and advocate for reforming campaign finance in this country, founder of the Mayday PAC, that was a crowdfunded political action committee devoted to funding candidates who pledged to reform campaign finance laws. We're going to take a very short break. Get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join our conversation as well. And who wouldn't? We're talking about money and politics. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane, talking with Lawrence Lessig about how to reform how we fund election campaigns. His most recent book is The USA is Lesterland. Lawrence Lessig, describe for us, you've said this several times, that it's really up to Congress to address some of these reform issues. What would you like Congress to do?
Well, there's a big push, some on the left and on the right, for Congress to enact, we could think of a small dollar public funding of elections. So what that means is, on the right, people are pushing the idea of Congress giving every voter a rebate in the form of a voucher. Think of a voucher that they can use to give to candidates who agree to fund their campaigns with small contributions only. And on the left, or in the Democratic Party, people like John Sarbanes, who's from Maryland, a five-term congressman from Maryland, has something called the Government by the People Act, which says small contributions will be matched up to 9-1. So if you give $100, it's worth $1,000 to the campaign. Now, both of these changes would shift the focus of campaigns away from talking to the tiniest fraction of the 1% and instead direct them to trying to attract many, many small contributions that either come from vouchers or come from these matching funds. And because they're focused now on many as opposed to a few, they'll be much more responsive to what the voters care about as opposed to what their funders care about. Those two changes don't require any constitutional reform at all. They could be adopted immediately, and I think that's the sort of thing we ought to be pushing for to begin us down a path of getting the government responsive to us again as opposed to responsive just to funders.
I've talked to a number of elected officials over the years, and they all complain bitterly about the fact that they have to spend so much time, frankly, begging for money, and yet here we are with the status quo. And people complain they don't like it, and yet here we seem to be stuck with it.
Yeah, we do. And you know, you got to think about the way the system doesn't actually breeds out leadership, right? You've got these people spending 30 to 70% of their time sucking up to the most powerful people in our country, you know, begging them, really begging them on the phone to give them money. Now, how can you do that 30 to 70% of your day and turn around and try to be a leader on any issue? That's not a leader. That's like learning to be the most obedient follower of the interest of the people who you're trying to beg money from. And we got to change that. We got to give members of Congress the chance to be leaders again by giving them a chance to actually lead, to do their job as congressmen rather than being these kind of low-paid, relative to what other telemarketers are paid, telemarketers, because that's not their job. That's not why we have a Congress.
There's a Facebook comment from Jay. He says the Koch brothers what the Koch brothers are doing is so un-American and also so American at the same time. The idea that rich people can call the shots.
Yeah, I get that. That's the way we think about our tradition, but it's really not our tradition. You know, the framers of our Constitution, they didn't understand lots about equality. They didn't get, you know, racial equality. They didn't get sexual equality. They didn't even know what sexual orientation equality was, right? So they were oblivious to a thousand dimensions of equality. But the one dimension they got, the one thing they thought was important, was to create a democracy that would be responsive, as Madison said, not to the rich more than the poor. And that one idea of equality is the one that our system has given up. We now have a system which is deeply responsive to the rich and not responsive to the poor. And that is the most important indictment of any democracy. But it's adding insult to injury to ours because our framers got this if they got anything.
But money is no guarantee of winning elections. I mean, talk to Eric Cantor, who got beat by a guy few people had heard of, a guy named Dave Brat in Virginia.
That's exactly right. It's not a guarantee, but you got to distinguish between what the money does and what people do to get the money. And what I'm focused on is what they do to get the money. So the reason Dave Brat beat Eric Cantor was that Dave Brat could go around his district and say, that guy is a crony capitalist. He spends all his time sucking up to Wall Street, trying to get Wall Street to give him money. And he does all sorts of favors to Wall Street. And he's not here in Virginia. He's spending all his time in New York trying to get the money from Wall Street, and that's why you should kick him out. And that message among conservative Republicans resonated powerfully. And so the point isn't that Eric Cantor had the money. The point is he had the time and spent his time raising the money from people who were not the people in Virginia who he was supposed to be representing. And he got punished for it. And I think that message is going to go viral in this next election cycle because there's been more conservative organizations. There's a new one called Take Back Our Republic, who run by the guy who ran David Brat's campaign, who have decided to take this issue and take it nationally, to force people to focus on who they should be focused on, their constituents, not the people who are funding campaigns in these large chunks.
Let me see what Bill from Media has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
My problem, I think, is with the way voters vote. And, of course, I myself, when I vote, I tend to vote for the person I think is going to do the best job. But what I see, and I did a little work on this about last year, that how people respond to advertising is that they tend to pick the product or they pick the candidate who seems most familiar to them, that they're most comfortable with. And this is the whole problem of name recognition. And why in the world should a lot of money and a lot of advertising make it possible for people to elect a bad candidate?
Hmm.
This is people are not thinking. If you really want to control the election, you've got to get people to think about the merits of the candidate instead of how often they hear the name.
Well, Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Lawrence Lessig, it is true that a lot of this money that gets raised and gets poured into ads, and then you get the wall-to-wall ads a month or two before an election.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, those ads are being sprayed across the television stations broadly, but they're targeting a very small number of people who the campaigns know they have a chance to try to switch one way or the other. And, you know, don't get me started about how insane the way that we try to talk to voters is. You know, it's completely non-consensual communication. Somebody's watching the Patriots game. That's what we talk about up here in
Yes,
Boston.
I understand.
An advertisement comes on from some politician trying to get you to vote for him. It's the last thing anybody wants to see. And yet that's the way we talk to each other about politics. And I could go on forever about how that system's terrible. But the point is, we can't do anything about that now, because that is firmly protected by the First Amendment, and it would require a constitutional amendment to begin to even touch that. So what I'm trying to focus on is the things we can fix right now, which don't require a constitutional amendment, but would have a real change in how our members of Congress think about doing their job. And the critical one, in my view, is get them to think about voters all the time, instead of just for a couple weeks before an election, rather than spending all their time thinking about funders, which is what they do right now.
And that's Lawrence Lessig, our guest in this portion of Radio Times. He's a professor of law at Harvard University, the director of the university's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Also is the author of a book that came out recently called The USA is Lesterland. And he is an advocate for reforming campaign finance in America, founder of the May Day PAC. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Excuse me, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What about public funding? Where do you come down on that?
So that's exactly what I was talking about, calling it small dollar public funding. I think that is actually absolutely the solution. Now, I don't support public funding in the way we used to publicly fund presidential elections, where the government kind of writes, one big check
right,
based on what they think it should cost. But I think bottom-up public funding is absolutely what we need. So if the government says, everybody, here's a $50 voucher, use that to fund campaigns, or we'll match your contributions up to 9-to-1, that's a kind of public funding, but the government isn't deciding who gets what or how much anybody gets. People are deciding that, and I think that's the critical kind of public funding we need.
Well, Obama used public funding and then ended up rejecting it because he saw that he couldn't keep up money-wise.
Yeah, I mean, every president between Nixon and Obama was elected through public funding of elections, and nobody benefited more than Ronald Reagan, who ran three national campaigns with public funding.
Yeah.
And the thing we forget is the way that affects what it means to be president, because when Ronald Reagan ran for re-election, he attended 8 fundraisers. When Barack Obama ran for re-election, he attended 220 fundraisers. Now, you know, I look at that and I think, how do you run the nation, the most powerful job in the world? How do you do that while attending 220 fundraisers? You know, if this were an employee at Walmart, we'd fire the person, right? But the point is, the system forces them to spend all this time raising money rather than doing their job. And the only way to get out of that is to go back to, you know, what we did after Watergate, which was to set up a system where people would rely on public funding to run their elections, especially for in the context of president, but I think also more critically in the context of what Congress does.
We have an email from Neil. He says, please ask why Congress would change a system that reelects them.
They won't unless we force them to, because individual members want to get reelected. And if voters start saying, hell no, I'm not going to support you unless you support fundamental reform, or I'm not going to give you a dime unless you support fundamental reform, eventually they'll figure they need to support fundamental reform and begin to push it. And we're beginning to see that, especially on the right. If you look at the rhetoric of Republican candidates for president, Pataki, Paul, Ryan, they have all begun to talk about corruption as a core problem that we need to address, and that's the first step to getting them to talk about solutions that would change the way Congress funds elections.
Let me get Jackie from Lawrenceville in on the conversation. Jackie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I live near Princeton, New Jersey, and one thing we're talking about just amongst ourselves is being issue-driven instead of ideology-driven, and that is getting people together to group as we saw before with small local groups. To be issue-driven. So we'd pop up for a cause. We'd have people gather, identify what's your cause. Is it education, environment, economy, immigration, whatever it is, once a week, once every 2 weeks, gather people together to come together for a cause because that's something they care about. And then instead of seeing and then that would drive which politicians, which elected officials would represent the causes that we care about. And there would be strength in numbers. We'd be visible. We'd be vocal.
Jackie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Lawrence Lessig, it sounds like the kind of, you know, bottom-up campaign saying these are things we care about. Where do you stand on them?
I think that's a brilliant idea. And I think all of those issues are incredibly important issues. You know, you can pick which issue is most important to you. For me, equality and climate change issues, those are the most important issues. But whatever the issue is, here's the critical thing to recognize. The issue I'm talking about is not more important than those. It's just first before those, because if we don't solve the way we fund elections, we're never going to solve climate change. We're never going to solve the equality issue. We're not going to solve the debt problem. We're not going to solve the tax problem. We're not going to have real health care reform. Nothing is going to change until we address this climate, until we address this way we fund elections. Now, that doesn't mean give up your work for climate change or whatever issue you care about. But I do think it means you should be tithing. You should be giving at least 10% of your effort, whether it's money or time, to the cause of trying to change the way we are funding elections. Because if all of these different incredibly powerful activist groups shifted at least 10% of their effort towards this more fundamental problem, we would have more than enough resources to actually bring about the change that we need to bring about. And what people have got to recognize is this is the foundational change that will make everything else possible. It's the first step. It's the first issue. And we've got to find a way to get people rallied around that first issue.
And you're listening to Ballot Talks here on Radio Times on WHYY. The Koch brothers, obviously in the news because of the amount of money that they're willing to spend. But there certainly are liberals and Democrats who are big spenders as well. Does it add up? Does it matter to you, Lawrence Lessig, what someone's political ideology is if we're talking about money?
It doesn't, because, you know, people sometimes think, oh, there are liberals, there are conservatives, it all balances out. But the thing is, the issues that liberal billionaires and conservative billionaires care about have nothing to do with the issues that ordinary Americans care about. Rich people's, you know, God bless them, but rich people's attitudes and judgments about America, this has been documented recently in a whole pile of work by Ben Barber, those attitudes have, Ben Page, I'm sorry, have almost no relation to the normal attitudes of American voters about critical issues which American voters care about. So this balance is not balance, it's just the balance among rich people, which you know, is interesting, but shouldn't be driving a democracy.
So what are your thoughts, or what is the thoughts of the May Day PAC as you look at the upcoming election in 2016? Is it back to the drawing board? As you said, probably some lessons from last year's election, but what do you want to think about or apply towards next election?
Well, in 2015, we're going to be launching next month a pretty amazing platform to turn the army that we've collected around to the task of recruiting voters to get their congressmen to support fundamental reform. We want to close the gap between the number who have committed and what a majority in Congress is, so that by the end of the year, people look at this problem and say, you know, it's not that hard. It only takes another 20 votes, or it takes another 30 votes. And once we've done that in 2015, then in 2016, if it looks like it makes sense to make this move, then what we'll be doing most likely is committed to nonpartisan interventions, meaning we're not going to be out there to try to take a seat away from a Republican and give it to a Democrat or vice versa. We're going to be out there in safe districts trying to get candidates who care about this issue without worrying about whether it's going to be a Republican or a Democrat. So safe Republican seats in primaries, safe Democrat seats in primaries, but all focused on this objective of getting a majority committed to fundamental reform so that by the next election cycle, candidates, especially candidates on the right, have a reason to talk about this, to raise this issue so that Americans can actually respond to the politicians when they talk about it.
In preparing for this interview, I was reading about you, a long piece in The New Yorker, and others have written about you as well. And one of the words that keeps coming up is quixotic. And I'm not sure it's always meant as a compliment. Do you feel like this is a quixotic quest on your part?
Yeah, it might be. And actually, that it's not meant as a compliment.
No, it isn't.
But I take it as a challenge, because what they don't say is that this isn't a problem. What they don't say is that our democracy is working. What they don't say is our kids actually have a future that we should be proud we're handing them. So when they tell me that, then I'll have a reason to stop. But until they can tell me that, what I say to them is, okay, what's your idea? What's your plan? Because we cannot allow this democracy to crumble the way it has. And we especially, we who've overseen this happening, I think have an obligation to step up and do something about it. So, yeah, it seems impossible, but I'm pretty confident we're going to see it through. We're going to see it succeed. And when it does, then the people who saw it as quixotic will remember that they always saw it was possible. They were certain it was going to happen, and they were always on the right side.
A perfect way to end our conversation. Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at Harvard University, the director of the university's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, an advocate for reforming campaign finance in America, founder of the May Day PAC, also wrote a book most recently called The USA is Lesterland. Coming up next, I'll be talking with Dave Davies and the former Treasury Secretary of Pennsylvania, Rob McCord, who resigned in a cloud. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Former Pennsylvania Treasurer Rob McCord surprised a lot of people last week when he resigned his post and pled guilty to extortion. He was caught on tape using the power of his office and veiled threats to get money from donors for his campaign for governor. He lost in the primary last year. Joining us now is Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. He writes Newsworks Off Mike blog. He is a regular on Radio Times. And Dave, nice to have you back on the show.
Good to be back.
It's sort of an odd place to start, but I want listeners to understand Rob McCord's, I guess, rise in politics and fall. This is a guy who worked in the private sector and won election for Treasury two times.
Yeah, he was a Harvard-educated guy who was in venture capital, but always had political ambitions. You could see he was making contributions and developing the kinds of relationships you do when you want to run for public office. He finally did run successfully for state treasurer in 2008. It's weird that we elect the person who is the state's fiduciary, but it's sort of one of those stepping stones to higher office. And people always said McCord's a comer. He could be a governor someday. He was reelected in 2012, raised a lot of money to do it, and then ran for governor last year unsuccessfully.
And he had been a guest on this show in the past. And from your observations and interviews with him, shall we say a big personality, big aggressive personality?
Yeah, a very impressive guy. I mean, I will say when I attended his announcement of his run for governor in September 2013, I walked away thinking, you know, this guy could be the state's next governor. I mean, I think he had real charisma. He spoke. He kind of linked his personal experience to policy issues and a vision. And just was a natural. He's one of those political naturals. And I moderated two of the gubernatorial debates that were held during the Democratic primary campaign, watched the others, and it struck me that McCord, more than the other candidates, thought well on his feet, didn't rely on stock canned answers. Most of the time I thought he won those debates. So the fact that he seemed policy smart and good at building political relationships suggested to me he had the tools to be not just an effective campaigner but a governor. And so I was thunderstruck when this happened.
And he has pled guilty to two counts of extortion.
Yep.
Extortion.
Correct. It's an ugly word, and when you read the facts, they fit.
Well, let me read a couple. And these were Rob McCord caught on tape talking to potential donors. Here's one quote. "Don't think that I'm so stupid that I'm not going to read you the riot act down the road. You know what I mean." He also said to someone they should not risk making an enemy of the state treasurer. Also said to another person, at the very least, I'm still going to be the freaking treasurer if he lost. I mean, this is really in-your-face kind of language.
Yeah, and kind of to set the context for folks who don't think about these things often, what you have here is a guy who is a public official and a candidate for governor asking for contributions and big ones, which are allowed in this state, and making it clear that there will be consequences, economic consequences. In one case, a very large law firm, and I'm sure a lot of people are wondering who the law firm was. It's Philadelphia-based. And in the other case, a property management firm in western Pennsylvania, both of which had either government business or government regulations that could be affected by the displeasure of a treasurer, and McCord being very clear about that. The other thing that's interesting about what you just read, Marty, is that we have exact quotes, which means that this was recorded.
Which means that the feds were investigating him, yes?
Yeah, and it's – you know, one of the things – having covered a few trials where FBI recordings are evidence, there's the words on a transcript and then there's the words when you hear them, when you hear the emotion. And I suspect that as kind of heavy-handed as these words are in a transcript, they're that much powerful on tape. When you can, I suspect that it would be very clear to a jury listening that he was very serious about getting these contributions or inflicting some consequences.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's a very familiar voice here at WHYY. That's Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. Again, writes the off-mic blog for Newsworks. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times to talk about former Pennsylvania Treasurer Rob McCord. He has pled guilty to two counts of extortion, resigned very quickly last week, and pled guilty very quickly last week, caught on tape using his office and even some veiled threats to get money from donors for his campaign for governor. Any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Dave, you had a piece sort of asking the question, is this normal? I mean, is this the way people operate in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, is it? I mean, we have the fact that in the state where you have no limits on contributions at all, it's quite common for candidates for public office and public office holders to be asking for contributions from people who have interests that would be affected by the offices that those candidates hold. And you always wonder, to what extent is there an implied or explicit quid pro quo, do this, you get that. And to learn that McCord was doing this in such a heavy-handed way was troubling. And I asked some folks. And,
right.
You know, one person who's a fundraiser, and in fact, I'll mention his name, Ken Jaron. He's done this a lot of years, and he said it really makes him angry when these things happen because he's very careful when he asks for money. And he says most public officials, when they ask for money, do it honorably. There's a right way and a wrong way to go about it. You never, ever, ever say that there will be consequences if you don't give. And, you know, I have to say, the fact that the FBI did managed to get tape recordings of McCord's remarks. When you read the criminal information that the prosecutors filed in Harrisburg, it seems likely to me that what happened here was that McCord went to these people a few times asking for contributions, and they were so appalled, so troubled by what they heard from him that they went to the U.S. Attorney's office and a wiretap was ordered, and they got him saying this, which would suggest that the managing partner of this law firm, who's not named,
right,
who's probably gotten many, many requests, had many, many conversations with candidates, found this way outside the norm. He said, this is BS. I'm not going to take this. And that's what led to the investigation. That's an inference of mine, but I think it's likely. And so that would suggest probably isn't that common.
Go ahead.
On the other hand, a lot of people would say, well, you don't have to have that kind of a conversation for the influence to be exerted. I mean, when I'm calling you and
– it's kind of wink, wink, nudge, yeah, nudge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to give you X in return for Y, but both parties understand that if I get a large contribution from you, I will remember that you were a friend when I needed one, and you're on my radar. I will take your calls, and if you want to compete for business, you will certainly get a fair chance, if not a more than fair chance. And so I think it's the unsaid stuff that in some ways may be just as troubling as the kinds of things we see in this case.
I think we often think of quid pro quo, which is that if you give me money, I will help you out this way. This is sort of the inverse of that, which is that if you don't give me money, I will punish you somehow.
Right. And the funny thing, I mean, the thing in the – and it's you can read these materials. I have a link to it on my blog, or you can go to the U.S. Attorney's website in Harrisburg. And it doesn't take that long, and it's interesting to read because apparently what he did with the law firm was they were prepared to give him $5,000. And this was not impressive to Mr. McCourt. No, I want 25.
Wow.
And he said, look, I understand you, the managing partners, are a supporter of the incumbent governor, Mr. Corbett. This is a tricky matter for you. And then he kind of suggests, well, you have this other partner at the law firm who happens to be a neighbor of mine, and he could give me the money and you could kind of give him a credit. So he was really working this. $5,000 won't cut it. You need 25.
He raised, I think, $9 million to run for governor. About two, a little bit more than two, was his own money that he kicked in. So he obviously raised a lot of money. And one wonders, and perhaps it's a matter of talking to a psychiatrist and not you, Dave Davies, which is whether this was sort of an act of desperation. I believe he came in third out of, what, four candidates? Or he certainly came in near the bottom. And whether what we're hearing is the act of a very desperate candidate. Maybe that's too speculative.
It's a question we can't answer, but there's been a lot of buzz among political fundraisers since this happened. And one thing I have heard, I've heard things that I wouldn't want to repeat because I have no way of verifying if they're accurate. But one thing that a lot of people say is Rob McGord was a very competitive and aggressive guy. He wanted to win in squash. He wanted to win in everything. And he was dead serious about raising the money he needed to get.
We have a tweet from Nate. Do these donors have legal recourse to get their donations back since they were coerced? Interesting question.
Well, in the case of these two, good question. I mean, you know, typically criminal prosecutions often come with fines and restitution. I'm not sure what the restitution guidelines would be here. You know, the federal prosecutors have looked at other donors. And it would be interesting to look back at the large contributions that McCord got from others and see whether some of them felt the same pressure. But you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office may or may not be looking at that.
These are serious charges, and my understanding, Dave, probably reading what you have written about it, is that each account of extortion could be as much as 20 years. So this is the potential, I guess, for some serious time. Who knows?
Yeah, it is. And nobody thinks he would be sentenced to 40 years. I mean, in these federal cases, there are sentencing guidelines which used to be mandatory for judges. Now they're simply advisory. But they take into account whether it was a first-time offense, how much money was involved, and a whole lot of other factors, including whether the defendant admits guilt and expresses remorse. So if he gets prison time, it's not going to be anything like 20 years, I don't think.
What would you like to ask him? What would you like to ask Rob McCord if you could interview him after this admission?
How many times did you do this before?
Whether this was a pattern or not?
Yeah.
Or something out of the ordinary?
Right. You know, you could imagine a scenario in which a guy, you know, throws his heart and soul and life into this governor's race. And remember that he was up against Tom Wolf, who was a self-funded millionaire and went on the air. And so despite whatever McCord's, you know, attributes and skills and talents are, he finds himself behind and desperate. And the only way to catch up quickly is to buy a lot of TV ads, and that costs a lot of money. And so, you know, he gets panicked and loses his moral bearings. The problem with that is there's just no way of knowing whether it's the first time, and it may have been the 30th time or the 50th time.
There was also, I guess, suggestions to give through third parties. Can you kind of take this apart for us, sort of how, even in Pennsylvania, how that works?
Well, the state election code makes it illegal for if I want to give to Marty, but I don't want to be seen to be giving to Marty. I could give it to Marty's producer, you know, Emily, and then Emily could give it to Marty. And if that's done with the intent to in effect launder a contribution, that's illegal. And there are a few cases like that. But it's kind of hard to prove if all the parties participate. I mean, there are a lot of different political committees with vague-sounding names, you know, the 21st Century Fund or whatever. And so it's not that hard to contribute to the 21st Century Fund to give to the 20th Century Fund, which then eventually gives to the candidate I want to. And it takes a fair amount of work to kind of track all that down. Reporters try and do it, but it's not easy. And then even when you track down the route, there's the matter of intent. So that sometimes does happen, yeah.
That's Dave Davies, again, senior reporter for WHYY. He writes a Newsworks blog off mic, and we are talking about former Pennsylvania Treasurer Rob McCord pled guilty to 2 counts of extortion. And Dave is taking apart the charges against Rob McCord, talking a bit about his rise in the political environment here in Pennsylvania. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Ballot Talks here on WHYY. Let me get Lynn from, it looks like, Willow Grove to join our conversation. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty and Dave. Dave, hi. I am so happy to hear your voice and what you're saying, because I was present at those early debates to hear Rob McCord. And I felt the same way that you did, that he would be like the gubernatorial candidate. I think I had like a 1% holdback that I didn't know what it was. But I felt the same way about Christie in the early years. So what's making these guys... You know, like you said, they go into panic mode, but there is something in that attitude. There's that 1% of them, you know, that is just like totally destroying everything good about them.
Well, let me say,
help
Lynn,
me understand.
Let me just say first about Chris Christie is that he has not been charged with anything, nor has he pled guilty to anything. So I don't want to it's not fair to make a connection,
Yeah, no, thanks. You know, Lynn, you make a good point. I mean, how do you ever really know kind of what's in somebody's heart? And it's funny. I mean, if you look at the piece I wrote Monday on Newsworks, I mean, I point out that there are moments when Rob McCord would be talking to you and giving you that winning smile and shaking your hand that you kind of felt he was working you a little bit, maybe looking over your shoulder to see if there's somebody more important. But they all do that.
Right.
And in some way, it did feel like there was something really authentic there. There's one other thing I'll just mention about this that would help, and that is reform in the state's campaign finance laws. We're one of only 11 states that has no limit at all on contributions. So, you know, some of these huge contributions would be illegal in some places. Now, the other thing Pennsylvania does not have, which I will say the city of Philadelphia does, is what's called a pay-to-play law. And that is a law which imposes specific restrictions and requirements on any political contributions from people who do business with the government. New Jersey has a pay-to-play law, and they're a little tricky. But I will tell you that in Philadelphia, I mean, historically, big law firms and big insurance companies would contribute $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 to mayoral candidates. And now, not only can they not do that, there are limits that nobody can contribute that much to a mayoral candidate in Philadelphia. But in a law firm, it's not even legal for you to have each of your partners go out and give the maximum acceptable limit, which is $2,900, and make that add up to $50,000, because there are what are called attribution rules. If you hold a fundraiser or you ask your friends and you participate in gathering checks for somebody, you can't go above a certain limit. And I think that does make it harder for these kinds of pay-to-play relationships to develop.
We're almost out of time. Are you saying, though, that Harrisburg could learn a few things from Philadelphia?
Yeah. Isn't that kind of amazing on the area of corruption? But I think if you look at what's happened in Philly in the last few years, there are some promising things.
Dave Davies, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. He's senior reporter for WHYY, writes the Newsworks Off Mic blog. I'm Marty Moscoen. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Stay with us. We'll be right back.